Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Jake Towns. Gene DiNardo's off this week, but he'll be joining us again next week. And we're here on this Thursday, September 29, 2011, and the headlines that are dominating the news hour today come primarily from the other side of the pond, where Germany basically passed a further bailout measure that's supposedly going to help stabilize the euro, I hesitate to call it a region, perhaps a regime. I'm not sure exactly what to call it, but Jake has the details. Jake, what's going on over in Germany?
Well, I'm not sure if you're going to stabilize it, but it means they're going to be printing a heck of a lot more money. The Germans, even though recent polls came out saying that the German population, so the man on the street, was against these bailouts by about a factor of 75% were against these bailouts. This today in Germany, over the U.S. morning, Germany Parliament voted overwhelmingly today. I believe looking for the vote total, voted overwhelmingly to pass the expansion of the bailout fund for heavily indebted European countries. There are continual votes. Slovakia will be voting, and this approval process is quite long. What this will do is increasing Germany's share of the loan guarantees from 211 billion euros to from about 123 billion euros. So to put that in relative terms, it's doubling the size of the fund, and with the population of Germany, it's pretty close to, on a per capita basis, the Wall Street bailout back in 2008. And again, all this money will be spent to plug debt holes, probably in Greece, provided it's still in the European Union at that time, and Spain and Italy, which also have massive problems, which aren't as much in the headlines as Greece, but are still there. So again, the U.S. Stock market took some solace from this. It leapt up at the beginning of trading, but you have to ask yourself the question, which is, you know, where are they getting, you know, this extra, you know, 211 billion euros? And they will be printing it, and so the European Central Bank will be playing a part in it, and also obviously the taxpayers at the end of the day are going to be paying it with their cost of living.
And of course, the big difference is the Fed and the European Central Bank actually work somewhat differently in relation to their respective governments. So the difference is that they have different ways of going about creating this money out of thin air, as we say, printing it, although actually there's no printing press involved, as we both know. But from what you've seen, do you think those differences in the way the European Central Bank interacts with the Eurozone are going to affect the way that money gets distributed? In other words, is it going to have a limiting effect on their ability to put the money that they want to put into the hands of the various banks that are in trouble?
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny, and I draw a lot of. I don't think fiscally the situation is quite the same, but draw a lot. You know, the vote that they passed was 523-85 in the German Parliament. But, you know, in terms of the differences between the Fed and the ECB, the European Central Bank, you know, it's tough to say, but, you know, because here they are, they're going to at least the politicians for approval. But the European Central Bank has already done so many things it said it would never do. It said it would never monetize the debt by going out and buying bonds of certain countries. They've done that. They have the power to do so. They have the power to print money. And in a lot of ways, I think this is just these votes are sort of to legitimize it to the public that, you know, the central banks are going to do what they're going to do. But it's kind of nice, you know, the German population obviously are going to blame their politicians for this vote. But, you know, the real folks that are in charge are really at the central bank. But the Fed has a lot more latitude. Technically, they didn't need to go to Congress in 2008. They did it anyways just to make sure that they had technically under the Fed's charter, they don't have to. Obviously, under the Constitution, they need to, but they do things without following the Constitution all the time.
What's new there?
Yeah. So I guess the key thing was Merkel's government has been really failing at each election that's been held throughout the past year, mainly due to all these problems with the EU and the bailout of Greece and everything. She was able to get the Social Democrats and the Green Party to join her Christian Democrat Party and pass this. But don't mistake me. Merkel was—they were celebrating. But the question is, what is this going to do in the future? Nothing good.
Yeah, well, we know it's going to be nothing good. We know that for a fact. The one thing that does catch my attention about it is, up until even last week's show, we were reporting how the news, various news agencies were saying Merkel didn't have the votes within her own parties, within her own coalition, let alone the opposition. And yet, here we come out with news today saying that they passed it with a lopsided 523-85 margin. I mean, there was some serious arm twisting going on in the background. There had to be.
Oh, sure.
And that's really the most interesting part of all, because, among other things, it shows that the European citizens have no more influence over their parliaments than we have over our Congress, because here in the United States, sentiment was overwhelmingly against the bailouts, and they went through anyway. And over in Europe, same sentiment and same result.
Right. And some surprise news. Reuters yesterday came out with an article that the rate of inflation in Germany has hit a surprise three-year high. For the September, the CPI is at 2.6%, which is up from 2.4% last August. And I'm not as familiar with the rates because, again, the U.S. government dramatically understates the true inflation rate. But, the central bank supposedly is supposed to be keeping these inflation rates below 2%. They're definitely failing visibly in Germany.
Yeah, they're failing all over the place, and that's going to become obvious more and more to the entire world population in the months and perhaps years ahead, although I don't think it's going to be years. I think it's going to be months. I think you probably do, too. I don't know if you saw, Bloomberg had an article this week, very interesting headline. Fisher says central bank is under attack from Ron Paul and Barney Frank, and the Fisher under consideration here is Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas President Richard Fisher, who was basically complaining that the central bank's independence is under attack from both ends of the political spectrum and Congress. And he singled out those two people as the main critics by name, namely Ron Paul and Barney Frank. And he says, quote, "We're being attacked from the right and from the left, and I don't see much difference between a certain congressman from Texas named Ron Paul and a certain congressman from Massachusetts named Barney Frank." That was a really interesting comment. I don't know if you saw the article, but just the fact that a Fed governor is coming out strongly against both Paul and Frank, particularly as we're approaching a presidential election cycle, and in the midst of the Fed being more and more unpopular as the days and even the hours go by, I found that to be a very interesting revelation to make.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, ultimately in 1913, the Federal Reserve was created as a creature of the Congress and supposedly reports to Congress. not really. But what's funny is, the politicians from really both sides of the aisle, you also saw that in Rick Perry's, remarks calling Ben Bernanke almost treasonous. They shift blame onto the central bank and try to blame them for all the things that are going on, and in some respect, and rightly so in a lot of ways. It's just that some congressmen, most of Congress, I would dare venture, is complicit with it, and there's only a few that are ideologically true and actually just want to fix the problem, which is to get rid of the Federal Reserve in the first place. And Ron Paul is the fellow trying to get rid of it. I'm sure a lot of the Democrats, I'm sure even Bernie Sanders, would just like to try to reform it or what have you. That's not going to work, because as long as they still have the power to debase the currency, that's exactly what they're going to do. Because when you as a country are spending $4 trillion and you bring in taxes of $3 trillion, you need to find $1 trillion somehow, and you're going to find that at the printing press, Ben Bernanke's printing press.
That's absolutely correct. Another interesting remark that came out of that article I was referencing came from a gentleman named Sung-Won Son, who is a former chief economist at Wells Fargo and Company. And Son was quoted as saying that while he believes that Fisher's remarks are true as a factual matter, a person in the position of president of a Federal Reserve Bank should be careful about what he says and how he says it, because the Fed actually reports to Congress, and Congress can do anything it wants to the Fed. Also an interesting comment, because basically he's saying to Mr. Fisher, yeah, you're right, but shut up.
Right.
I don't know how else to interpret that, but that's basically what it amounts to. It's almost like the code of silence was violated or something. That's what it sounds like, you know, the Costa Nosa or something like that.
But, well, yeah, and the thing is, like, when you press Ben Bernanke on a lot of things, you know, when you press him on the unemployment, you know, he just came out yesterday and was calling it, you know, a national crisis. You know, it's kind of like, okay, finally you figured it out after, you know, 3 years. You know, they shift the blame on the Congress, and it's just kind of like a blame game. You know, Congress blames the Fed, Fed blames Congress. Meanwhile, you know, they're accomplishing their purposes, which is, you know, the growth of government, the bailouts to the bankers, and kind of like the corporatocracy of the world. You know, just take a look at the Goldman Sachs alumni all over the Treasury Department, and how that firm is doing.
Absolutely true.
Bankers' bonuses.
Also interesting, and in the news this past week, leading up to that German vote, there was a lot of turmoil in the markets, as there has been for really since the middle of the summer. And the turmoil, among other things, hit commodities very hard. Gold and silver in particular took a hit. Gold down below the $1,700 mark, silver down below the $30 mark. And that, of course, gives ammunition to those who say that there's no need to put your money into gold or silver, that the whole thing is just a bubble and is about to burst, and sure enough, here's the bursting and so forth. But that's not really the case, is it? This is more like a short-term result, probably due to bank manipulation, central bank manipulation of gold and silver. And I mean, my own guess is it's going to turn right around and go right back up again.
Yeah, it might take some time to repair it, because, again, we talked about the show a few weeks back, and it was kind of like the precursor to it was when the Swiss National Bank said that they were going to devalue their currency and peg itself to the euro so it could keep exporting. You know, the Swiss franc plummeted against gold by 10%. But just right before the Swiss National Bank's announcement, gold was hit hard and taken down, and that's kind of continued. You know, there is options expiration. You know, the price of gold and silver is not determined on the street. It's determined really on these futures markets. But, you know, gold ended up going down from its high of 1900 down to right now it's resting at a little bit above 1600. So it took it down about 15-18%. Silver was taken down for a few minutes as it was at $26 an ounce from, you know, roughly about $40 an ounce or so. Now it's a little bit above $30 an ounce. So it went down by, you know, at one point over 25%, which is a massive shift. But when you take a look at the other markets that really haven't changed much, like the Dow hasn't changed much, the oil price, you know, the price of oil as we speak is about $83 a barrel, which was what it was, you know, a fair time ago. Even when you take a look at copper, copper has been hit. It's right around $3.30 or so, but that's roughly the amount that gold went down. And it's, I think we've kind of seen the bottom in the gold and silver markets, but you're exactly correct when you say, you know, there's a reason why these things occur. It occurs, you know, in my estimation, in order so that the shorts, which are pretty much the bullion banks or JP Morgan or what have you, so they can clear their short side and get back in on the long side to kind of make money both ways in this market. But it's also there to scare out future buyers and keep them out by saying, oh, you know, this stuff is very unstable. When all these things that are going on, like all the stuff going on over in Europe where they're, you know, kind of in a state of paralysis and trying to do something, it's just not working and it's not going to work, is, you know, people are looking for a safe haven. They were sort of looking at dollars, but you know what the Fed did with the Operation Twist by trying to sell its short-term securities and buy its longer-term securities in order to depreciate the interest rate. A lot of that's going to affect, you know, the countries that hold securities, whether it's the European countries or China. And by keeping the interest rates down, they're going to keep their holdings roughly the same, so they won't sell them. And it's a very poor investment. I think the whole treasury markets, at the end of the day, will be a bubble. But it's going to take probably a few years for that to play out. But who knows? It might, the end might come a lot faster than either you or I think.
I do think that it's going to be a very volatile situation, particularly where precious metals are concerned, and I think we're going to see a lot more activity even before the end of this year. I would not be surprised to see the whole thing bouncing right back up again. In fact, I would say that probably the one takeaway from all this, well, first of all, I have to admit, I got a little bit lucky. I was able to stop out of my silver trade, and so I actually bought back in at a much lower price. I ended up getting more shares as a result. As listeners may know, I invest on my IRA fund in the ETF SLV, which invests in silver, and which of course has its own issues associated with it. But the point is this: if you really want to be investing in physical silver rather than in the ETFs, and when you invest in physical silver or physical gold, and if you bought at the higher prices, just wait it out, because it's all going to come right back to where you were. And if you haven't started to protect your financial situation by buying silver, buying gold, now's the time to do it, because the prices are down. They aren't going to go a whole lot lower than this. They could possibly go down a few dollars, but not a whole bunch more, and the upside potential is tremendous. So my own personal recommendation would be buy gold, buy silver now while the prices are down.
Right, and back in 2008, before gold and silver both got hit during the Wall Street crash, gold was at $1,000 an ounce, and silver was at $1.21 an ounce. And they ended up going down. I think gold went down to 700, silver went down $8-$9 at one point. But you know, the thing was, anybody that bought even at the tops of that market are still up, 60% in gold, and they're up, still up 50% in silver even after this, massive collapse. So it's something where I think the point that we're at now is maybe, as long as you're buying gold under 2,000. As long as you're buying silver under 40 bucks, in a few years' time, you're not going to see much difference. But like you said, it's hard money assets and they're on sale. And again, in a normal market, you're not going to see commodity go down by 25% over the span of a few days.
Yeah, it's
and
a
most of the
market.
Most of the hits that occurred, if you take a look at the trading ticks, happened in the lightly traded Asian market in the beginning of the London market hours.
Right.
And they just kind of continue their waterfall ascents, because you blow out all these stops, all these stop-loss trades, and it just keeps going down and down and down. And sure enough, it sure went down a lot. And, people were buying at the bottom, but in a typical market where that happens, why does the price go down? Because, either demand goes down or supply goes up. So, but when you take a look at a lot of these places where you can buy silver, they're out of stock, or they sell you what they have and they immediately have to replace it with new stock. So the big drain on the physical silver, and that's eventually where this will end up. Like, we'll learn that, these paper markets or these future markets that are trading in gold and silver, like we learned in our interview with Bill Murphy of the group GATA, which you can find at GATA.org, that really what it comes down to is the governments are working to suppress the price of gold, and to a lesser extent silver, in order to make their own currencies look good. And there's plenty of information which you can find at GATA.org, or you can view the archives at ProgressiveNewsHour.com for our show, and look up the Bill Murphy interview.
Mm-hmm, that's right. There's also, you mentioned the fact that dealers often run out of the physical metal. There was actually an article about that at King World News a few days back. Sprott Money, which is one of the large gold and silver dealers, completely ran out of silver during the last price drop. That's an interesting point. Price of silver is going down, and they ran out of silver.
Yeah, and again, any of these silver places, what they need to do is they need to replenish, to avoid taking a loss, they have to place an order for the same amount. So if they're, or they try to get as much of a break in the prices, and they put a premium on the metal and what have you, but you know, still it's market behavior that is not very natural. I'm sure over where we're going into in the Asian physical markets is going to be a heck of a lot more than it is here in the U.S. and, you know, the Indians and the Chinese, you know, when they see that and the Vietnamese and all these other people over there that recognize true wealth, when they see this, you know, sale, you know, there's kind of very little doubt that they're buying into this very hard. So, right. Again, like what's probably happening is the physical metal is flowing from these central banks out to Asia and to anyone who's buying the physical metal. And these future markets, which, again, very few of these contracts actually settle, like less than 1% of the contracts on the gold market ever actually settle for gold, we're going to find out.
Oh, we definitely will. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then after the break, we're going to come back with two guests, special guests joining us today, Tom Morgan and Jimmy Patterson, who are authors of a recently released book, are going to be talking about capital punishment. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. We will take a break, and then we'll be back after a few minutes. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. Don't you know you better run, run, run.
You're listening to the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm John Mueller from the Expat Files, living in Latin America, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire in Latin America. I want to tell you that my Monday night program has now moved to Tuesday at the same time, 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. But my Wednesday night program will remain the same, also at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And remember, you can email me about anything and everything concerning Latin America, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos!
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
You're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
Yeah, run back to your dial, because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown, and we're welcoming two guests today on the program. From Texas, Jimmy Patterson has 25 years' experience as a newspaper writer, reporter, and editor, and Tom S. Morgan is a defense attorney who has won most of his 395 jury trials, interestingly enough. And together they have written a novel called, I believe, The Chiselous Mountain Sunset, and they're here to talk about the novel and their experience with capital punishment. So, gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Tom, I want to start with you. Is it really true you've won most of your jury trials? I mean, from my understanding, for defense attorneys, that's particularly unusual.
Yeah, this is Tom. I'm sorry, Walt.
Tom, hi there. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hi there. I was just wondering, I read a little bit about your background in the intro and mentioned that you had won most of your 395 jury trials, which seems rather remarkable because defense attorneys normally don't get to pick and choose who they're going to be defending, but you seem to have a great track record. Is that true? How did you manage to pull that off?
Well, I had in state court not too long ago, I went through all my jury trials. 72% of the time, my clients were found not guilty or had a hung jury, which a hung jury is a victory for the defense simply because there's no conviction.
Okay.
Or had a felony that was reduced to misdemeanor by the jury, and my client was found not guilty of a felony. That's 72% in state court. Now, in federal court, the U.S. attorneys typically don't take the case unless they're basically gut cinches. Now, out of the federal jury trials, I've had 60. I've won 14 and lost 46, which actually is pretty good for federal court. You just don't take them unless they're truly are gut cinches. So that's my track record. But yeah, 72% of the state court level, I won.
Well, very good. That's an interesting and impressive track record. And then, Jimmy, you have quite a background as a newspaper editor and writer. That must have served you well when it came to writing the book.
It has. So, Walt, it's come in quite handy. I've been a writer for probably 30 years total, 25 at the Reporter Telegram newspaper in Midland, Texas, and for the last 6 years I've been the editor of the Catholic newspaper that serves the Diocese of San Angelo, Texas. And this is my actually second book, and my third one was just released next week, and that's the history of the diocese here in West Texas. So I keep myself busy.
Well, very good. Jimmy, tell us a little bit about, first of all, what led you guys to write the novel, and then we want to get into the issue of capital punishment itself, because that's really the core topic that made us want to bring you onto the program. But just give us a little overview of the novel.
Well, I appreciate Walt, I'm glad that you would point to questions on capital punishment to Tom. He's the expert. I kind of like it myself as an actor who plays a forensic scientist. The actor doesn't know anything about DNA, so but I've got opinions on the death penalty, certainly. But Tom is your expert on that. But I Tom and I met. I guess it's been almost 2 years now, and decided that we were going to set some of his cases into novels. And the first one we did together, it's turned out to be quite a success here, and we're enjoying the feedback we're getting, and I'm currently working on the second one that will probably be out, I would guess, next summer, and then we have a third one in the works as well. So,
okay, so there's a sequel coming, or a couple sequels, I should say.
It's not a sequel. The second one will have the same character, the attorney character that's the protagonist in this novel. But it won't be. The storyline will be completely different. It's a completely different case. And the third one is sort of in the visionary stages. And I'm thinking about even changing the time frame and going back several decades on that one. But we're not really ready to really seriously discuss that quite yet.
That's understandable, no problem. And I know that our engineer is trying to work out that echo problem that we're having with Tom, but while they're working on that, could you just give us a quick overview of what your own thought process was that brought you into the whole idea of writing a novel about capital punishment? That's a pretty unusual topic.
It is, and in fact, it sort of unfolded and sort of became that along the way. It was really a story about a police shooting in West Texas that happened back in 1988. In the reality of the story was that it was not a capital punishment case. Both of the police officers who were
at, whoop, did we lose you?
I killed one of the police officers, if you will, in the story, and brought in the capital punishment aspect of the book as a result of the crime.
Okay, very good. And what do your own views on capital punishment? How do they affect what you guys did when you were writing the book?
Well, from a personal standpoint, I certainly. Being of a faith that I am, the church had certainly against capital punishment, and
I've certainly been taught all of my adults that
life and at the end of life, regardless of how difficult it is. At that point, we're not brought here to be judges, and we're not here to be God. We're here to, those are left up to God. Those decisions should be left, and this doesn't even cover the expense of a capital punishment, how much money it costs the state, that, you know, money that could be better spent elsewhere, on education, for instance, if you didn't have to spend $2.3 million on each person that is put to death. So, but my views are mainly from a moralistic standpoint, what the church teaches, what I believe, that's where I stand on it.
Okay, very good. And Tom, I think we've got you back on the line.
I'm here.
Jimmy says that you're the expert on the capital punishment side of it, so why don't you give us a little bit more detail about how you went about addressing that issue, because it is a very touchy issue, particularly in Texas. I find it interesting the point of view that you guys are taking in Texas, because throughout the South and so forth, there's a very strong emphasis on capital punishment among much of the population.
It is. I would say in Texas, a majority of the people favor the death penalty. They're not opposed to it. I will say that I've kept fairly close track of capital murder trials when the district attorney was seeking the death penalty in West Texas and the Panhandle. And over half the jury trials, while the jury did not assess the death penalty, even though it costs a huge amount of money just to get that far. So juries out here take it very, very seriously. They're not quick to vote in favor of the death penalty. Some certainly have. The governor of Texas, I don't think, could block an execution if he wanted to, although he stated publicly he would not do that anyway. The cost to the taxpayer seeking the death penalty is beyond enormous.
The
lawyer has to basically shut down the office and just work on that one case.
You had mentioned the figure of $2.3 million per death penalty case.
Back to a 1993 Dallas Morning News article.
Okay, it's probably a lot more now.
$2.3 million per case. One thing that does, I personally am opposed to death penalty. That's just me personally. Thou shalt not kill. But there's one thing that I would like to pass on. The current district attorney of Dallas County, who's a very fine district attorney, he has been willing to let DNA come in. I mean, is somebody on death row wrongfully? And it's my understanding, as of about 2 years ago at a seminar, there had been like at least 17 men on death row who had been released because through DNA testing and modern science, they were not guilty.
Wow.
I do tip my hat to the district attorney of Dallas County for wanting to get to the truth. With regard to appeals, I know it takes a long time to do a death penalty appeal. There's a case out of Midland County. It wasn't my case, but jury assessed the death penalty, I would say, 7 years ago. That case is still in the federal courts. He has not been executed. The cost is just mounting. With regard to the death penalty in Texas, it is up to the jury. Jury selection takes anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks. You have to bring the people in one at a time. It is very, very tedious. It shuts down one of the courts for a long period of time, usually a good 2 months. That court can do nothing except that one case. Now, with regard to the death penalty, to me, I am not convinced. I've had 395 jury trials. I'm not convinced that anyone who's about to commit a major crime like this thinks about their punishment. I just don't think now, if I kill them, I'll get the death penalty, but if I don't, I'll get life in prison, probably without parole. I don't think they think about that at all. I really don't.
If I might add, too, one of the things that when I was traveling over in Brussels, over in Europe, I came across the copy of the European, not quite their constitution, but kind of like the Declaration of Rights. And Article 2 in that is that all people have the right to life, and it states, you know, quote, everyone has the right to life, period. No one shall be condemned to a death penalty or executed, unquote. And they have a couple of things in there, like in case there's insurrection and the government still want to kill people. But I thought that was very interesting, you know, based on the morality of it. You know, not only it's you know, basically impossible to determine 100% that someone committed a crime, but even in those cases where you have videotape or hundreds of other people saw them, you know, the cost of doing such a thing and the morality of it is just completely off. And from seeing that, and, you know, I'm not suggesting that we copy everything that the European Union does, but in this one respect on capital punishment, I thought it was a pretty good idea. Do you guys know of, or do either of you know of any motions or anything like that to try and put something like that in place here in the United States or even on a state level?
Well, I'm pleased to say in April of 2009, Walt, I went to a seminar in Santa Fe, New Mexico, put on by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And we had a luncheon, and we honored the key state representative in New Mexico who sponsored abolishing the death penalty. And it passed, and it became law. So this was April of 2009. It had just passed maybe 2 or 3 months earlier or something like that. And so we gave him a standing ovation. We gave this legislator a true standing ovation. I think there were some civilians who were also and very involved, and it put a smile on my face that a state so close, in fact, we live within an hour of New Mexico, has abolished the death penalty. It was pleasing to me personally, and I think there are some other states, perhaps New Jersey, maybe another one that has now abolished the death penalty. The cost is so prohibitive, and majority of jurors don't give the death penalty, even though you've incurred this great expense. Again, shut down a court completely, and the appeals are going to go on and on and on.
Tom, one of the perceptions that I have is, and of course this just comes from the sensationalization of it through the major media, but the sense that I get is they get it wrong as often as they get it right. Is my perception off?
No.
And that's really, that's a frightening idea, because what that really suggests is that we are, our state governments are killing people without justification.
That's a major concern of mine. I will say, by the way, I had a federal capital murder I got appointed to in February of 2008, and it took the Attorney General of the United States till the first week of November to decide whether or not to seek the death penalty. This was like the week of the election, and they decided against it. I've had another pending federal capital murder in which the current U.S. Attorney, Eric Holder, took months, but he finally decided against seeking the death penalty. These are murders in the course of a drug trafficking crime. I'm glad they did not seek the death penalty. One of them here recently in the Midland Odessa area involved one of the decedents who was apparently very definitely a member of a Mexican drug cartel. And I don't think that people were all that sad to see him be killed, but it is coming across the border, and I just got to pass that on to you. Some of these decedents did not receive a whole lot of sympathy.
Jimmy, I wanted to go back to you for a moment, basically along the same lines, the question being how often the courts get the death penalty wrong and apply it to somebody who turns out later to be innocent. You have a slightly different perspective as a newspaper editor and writer. What do you see from your point of view? Do you see a lot more wrong than right in terms of how often they get it wrong or get it right?
I wasn't a news editor in the sense of the day-to-day operations of
of the newspaper making those decisions. I can't, I shouldn't comment on that. I could make a personal observation with the homicide of Mr. Davis, I believe is his name, in Georgia just last week. I believe that was quite wrong. I mean, the people that recanted their testimonies and whatnot should have been enough right then and there to make that decision go away and be reversed. Unfortunately, you can't undo an execution, and that's certainly the ultimate penalty and the ultimate decision, because you can't change your mind on that. Where you can release someone if you find him innocent if he's still alive, but you can't if he's not here anymore. And that would be where I would stand on that one.
Okay. And Tom, one more question, kind of along the same lines, but a little bit different tack this time. Non-capital cases that don't involve the death penalty, how often do the courts get it wrong and how often do they get it right?
I think they get it definitely right more than they do death penalty cases. So much the emotion goes out of it. I know juries here in Midland County are well educated. They do tend to go off on reason and common sense, especially when the death penalty is not involved. I would say they get it right more when their death penalty is not being sought.
So there's actually an argument to be made that by including a death penalty in the overall trial structure, it actually upsets the ability of the legal system to render a just verdict.
Well, the publicity is usually enormous when there's a death penalty sought. And frankly, in one case I had, there was no way my client could not have been presumed innocent. When you have this pounding of media and how horrible it was, and the jurors cannot take it out of their mind. They might say they can, but they really can't. And he's presumed guilty, and it's exceedingly difficult to get a fair trial, especially when the death penalty is sought. And the publicity is constant about how horrible it was. And there's nothing in the paper about the good chapter in the book of my client's life. That didn't hit the paper, the news media. When the death penalty is not sought, the publicity is definitely not as great.
It's interesting how publicity can make such a big difference in basically bending the will of the judicial system. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the program. We wish you the best luck with your book. Do you have a website to help to promote the book?
Well, actually, Walt, we do, and I thought maybe I'm glad you asked. So I don't know that you might have mentioned it before we came on the air, the title of the book, which is Jesus Mountain Sunset. It's set in the Big Bend region of Texas. The actual crime occurred in Fort Stockton, and the crime, or the book, has been moved to the Alpine Terlingua area in between those two towns in this huge Big Bend region of the state that we're quite proud of. Out here, and there is a website. It's JesusMountainWebsite.com. You can get an excerpt there, and the book's available at Barnes & Noble and at Amazon.com, and pretty much anywhere you can buy a book.
All right. Well, Tom Jesus, Morgan and Jimmy Patterson.
C-H-I-S-O-S.
Thank you so much for joining us on the program today. Our readers who are interested, I'm sure, will check out the website, and we wish you both the best as you pursue your various careers.
You bet. This is my favorite jury trial out of all 395.
All right.
Thanks.
And we'll be
Thank
back
you.
In a moment. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, back after these messages.
Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
Progressive Radio News Hour features in-depth discussions and full disclosure of cutting-edge world and national issues. Distinguished guests explain them, taking aim at policies harming so many people worldwide. Change comes through understanding and a commitment to something better. The Progressive Radio News Hour is dedicated to working for it by providing listeners with vital information they need to know. Listen Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
Is a state of emergency. No, it's not. It's more of a state of urgency. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm on the radio Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, offering a different narrative to the news, challenging what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're reading, offering another way of understanding what's going on. Join me online on MediaChannel.org and join me here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com Fridays at 1 p.m. Be there. Or be square.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Once again, we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, surviving meltdown, and back to the headlines, where we find, among other things, unemployment continues to be a ravaging problem to the point where even Ben Bernanke admitted this past week that it is a major problem, and it's actually popped up even worse than was expected. Jake, what are the details about that?
Sure, yes. Following Ben Bernanke's talk about the national crisis in jobs, which, again, you know, we're glad he caught on after 3 years of this.
Yes.
The jobless claims this week did drop more than the forecast. The jobless claims came in at 397,000, I believe. 397,000, which is a bit lower than like the last couple weeks, which is at 423,000. But, you know, relatively speaking, again, these are just estimations for first claims for unemployment payments. There's really no statistical difference between the numbers of last week and currently. So, unfortunately, you know, there's no sight, no end in sight to this unemployment problem that we do have. And unfortunately, the people that are in charge of dropping it, namely the Federal Reserve and the federal government, are exactly the ones that are exacerbating the problem.
Oh, yes, exactly true. And that's the really sad part, because ultimately the only way to resolve the employment issue is to resolve the monetary system, because until that monetary system levels out, there's not going to be any way for anyone who's in business, large or small, to be able to predict that, yes, there's going to continue to be a market and even a growing market for their goods and services. As long as that's the case, the opportunity for more jobs to come out there is just going to be non-existent.
Right, and we've gone over how these central banks, when they print money, they end up creating this boom-bust cycle. But even more important is, you know, stable purchasing power. The reason why it's so, or, you know, relatively stable purchasing power, it's so important because it's used as a tool for economic calculation. If you're a firm out there, you know, just kind of like how you said, you know, you have to go out there into an environment and say, okay, I need to provide these goods to these people or this service to this people, and to write up a business plan and everything. It really kind of masks a lot of the monetary system that we have, masks a lot of the capital destruction that we have going on in our country. For instance, you know, if we had stable money, if you start the year with 100 units of money and then end with 110 units of money after all costs are paid, you've made a 10% profit. But unfortunately, with inflation, if you make that same 10 monetary units or whatever, you have to subtract out inflation. And, you know, the government's figure is, it's right around 3% or 4%. But the fact of the matter is, if you take into account, you know, anything from electricity to trash collection to bread to eggs, to anything that you want to buy except for things, technological goods such as computers, which do drop. The prices are all rising. And, for the average American, they're seeing inflation 10% or so, I would say, would be a rough number even now. So that wipes out your profits. So you can't calculate it. And when you see this whole bust occur, it becomes a lot harder for people to kind of, dip their feet into the pond, so to speak, and start up a business.
And, of course, the people who get hit the hardest are the people who are at the lower end of the economic spectrum, the people who are the day laborers, the wage laborers, and so on and so forth, some of the lower-end salary people. They're the ones who are most often the ones who get laid off, and they're also most often the ones who are involved in losing their homes because of the pricking of the real estate bubble. So it's been a double whammy for them. And until you get a relatively stable monetary situation, the economy can't recover.
Right.
It's just... people don't seem to realize it. Certainly the politicians don't realize. The people talking on the major media don't realize it. And the people who are in the majority in financial circles are basically Keynesians, and they're arguing the old Keynesian line that you have to just keep spending in order to get the economy built up again. But they just don't realize. It doesn't work that way, particularly in the lower echelons of society. It doesn't work that way. It may work just fine if you're a major corporation and your biggest concern is can you get a huge loan so you can launch another product. But when you're talking about a small businessman, it's an entirely different picture. And it's a picture that's completely dependent on having a level, stable money supply.
And even more worse off, I would say, than the day laborer or the people making 10, 15 bucks an hour is really the group of retirees that might get Social Security pension checks. But they're the increases that they get, or I should say lack of increases, there hasn't been an increase in Social Security for a couple of years now, is not keeping up with the cost of goods and services that they need to keep themselves alive and medical care and all these things. And it really just kind of impoverishes people. And, when you look around and, you see who has the money, well, a lot of our money, at least $1 trillion out of the $4 trillion that the U.S. government spends is devoted to defense. I would say, actually, the majority of that $1 trillion is not defense at all. It's militarism, all these wars that we have abroad, thousands, tens of thousands of troops in Korea, in Germany, in Japan. Vast expense. And then secondly, you just have all the inefficiencies of the federal government. It's kind of a sad story.
It is a sad story, very sad story.
When you look at the people that are doing well, troops or federal government employees, I think it's like 18% of all federal government employees make over $100,000 a year, which is ridiculous. But the bankers, Goldman Sachs and what have you, those people are certainly not feeling the pinch of the hard times, because they can make money just as easily when wealth is being destroyed through a lot of these stocks and bonds and stuff, as long as they know which way the markets are going, and that's why they're kind of in cahoots, or they actually are the government in some cases.
Plus, there's also the little fact that they get the bailouts and we don't.
Right.
So it's an ongoing circle. Also in the news this past week, has been going on for the last few months, the Republican race for the presidential nomination continues to ride along on its rocky road. The latest candidate gaining attention from the major media appears to be Herman Cain, the former pizza mogul. And he came out with a book this week, didn't he, Jake? In fact, the book had a rather interesting revelation in it.
Yeah, the book is called "This Is Herman Cain," describing the current GOP presidential candidate. But what's funny is he makes it clear in the book that he's being hounded by supporters that he says are from Ron Paul, that they say keep showing up and asking him with their quote unquote stupid questions about the Federal Reserve. And, if you watch any of the debates, it always just comes up that, he's the former CEO of Godfather's Pizza, which, the average American looks at and is like, at least he isn't a career politician like the rest of the guys on the stage. But then, they fail to realize that he was the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City for a few years, and so he's a banker himself, and in a lot of ways I think he's the most dangerous man on the stage, since he is very much for You know, he may not say it publicly, but make no mistake, he is a Keynesian to the core, and he believes in the Federal Reserve. He also wrote in his book that he believes that Paul's supporters are threatened by me and are, quote, trying to destroy me on the fact that I was once affiliated with, unquote, the Federal Reserve. So he says that every time he shows up to speak, Ron Paul is sending one of his supporters everywhere that he shows up, which I find to be ridiculous.
Who knew the Paul campaign was that organized?
Right, exactly. And he wrote a further quote, quote, I get the same stupid question at almost every one of these events. I know it's a deliberate strategy. How can a person randomly show up at 100 events and ask the same stupid question to try and nail me on the Federal Reserve? It's really becoming more annoying more than anything else, unquote. So,
well, the chances are that Herman Cain does not listen to our radio program. But just on the off chance that he does, I would like to send a message out to Mr. Herman Cain. And the message is this, Mr. Cain. Is it possible, is it remotely possible, that perhaps a large segment of the population are finally catching on to what the Fed's been doing to us all these years, and that that's the real reason people are following you around and asking these stupid questions about the Federal Reserve? Maybe, sir, that's the reason why you're being hounded. And if that's the case, sir, you deserve it.
Right, and just like you said in the Fisher comments, it's Barney Frank, you know, a leading Democrat bringing questions. It's Ron Paul, who's from the Republican Party, of course. And it's the independent slash socialist senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, that is also being highly hypocritical of the Federal Reserve. So there's a lot more people than, you know, just these folks that are showing up at these Herman Cain rallies, apparently.
And I sincerely hope that more and more people do show up at the Herman Cain rallies and ask him about his experience running the Federal Reserve and ask him why we should be putting a banker, of all people, in charge of the federal government. Because that is really what the question comes down to, where Herman Cain's candidacy is concerned. It's been bad enough having, you know, the top career politicians, Republican and Democrat, end up in the Oval Office. But what happens if a bankster, and I use that term advisedly because the term bankster is a derogatory term that is a combination of banker and gangster. And I think in this case it's one that really does apply, because any person who has a strong banking orientation like Mr. Cain does, who wants to gain access to the Oval Office and who retains his ties to the banking community, that's a dangerous person to have in that office.
Oh, for sure.
No doubt about it. Well, we're nearing the end of the hour. We've got about 3 minutes left. There's one other interesting story that you had brought to the table, and I wanted you to have a chance to bring it up. It's about an event that happened at a Boeing plant. What are the details on that particular story?
Just 5 hours ago, the FBI has raided a Boeing plant in the city of Philadelphia that makes military helicopters, and charged more than 37 people with distributing or trying to get prescription drugs. Mainly the drugs that are actually listed in the press release are powerful painkillers. So the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, showed up at a 5,400 employee park where, you know, for defense contractors. They stated that it does not appear to be an organized drug ring. From my reading of it, it kind of sounds like these are just Boeing employees that are peddling painkillers and what have you to each other and prescription drugs. So it'll be interesting to get a little bit more details on this. You know, it's funny to see our federal government, you know, spending time in such a way. This particular Boeing plant does have some not very good highlights in its past. It shut down two production lines that make the Chinook and Osprey helicopters after they found a plastic water cap in the fuel line of it. They also shut down the factory in May of 2008 when a disgruntled employee used his wire cutters to cut a whole bunch of wires in a nearly finished Chinook since he was... He pleaded guilty to destroying property under contract to the government, and he said he was upset about a job transfer. So, you know, very interesting. It's not every day that the FBI raids a military factory.
No, not at all. That is pretty unusual. Well, we're down to about the last minute here. I just want to touch on one last quick story while we have time left here. I don't know if you saw this one, Jake, but it came from our friends at GATA, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, an article by Chris Paolo entitled, "Where is Mexico's Gold, and Is It Really Gold at All?" And I can't really get into the article in great detail, but I'll read the first paragraph if I have time for it. And I don't think I actually do have time for it, but the question is, are the 93 tons of gold it claims to have purchased this year actually in control of the Mexican government? And the reason this is important is there has been a lot of speculation in the weeks and months in recent times saying that perhaps a lot of the gold that is supposedly controlled by the central banks really isn't there. And I guess we'll have to leave it there because we're out of time. Jake, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Hey, it's been great. Everybody stay free. And I think as far as we know, Venezuela, that we talked about on the show, they still haven't gotten their gold back yet either.
Absolutely not. And we will see you next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.